Welcome to this Brink podcast on climate litigation. I'm Svenja Zaminski, Managing Director at Marsh McLennan Advantage and responsible for thought leadership on climate and sustainability. Today's topic is not really new, but it has grown in importance in the face of a changing climate and rising losses and damages. The number of climate change-related litigation cases has more than doubled since 2015. Reaching, I believe, a total of 2,000 recorded cases worldwide. And almost every large law firm now has a climate change team, and judges have been reading up on the science to better understand the complexities and challenges that this topic brings with it. Over the last few years, climate litigation has become some sort of instrument used to enforce or enhance climate commitments with governments or major emitters, the so-called carbon majors, as the main targets, usually challenging their responses to climate change. But as the world gets hotter, there's also now growing focus on possible legal recourse for the losses and damages resulting from climate change. So while initially seen as a form of protest by activists, the focus of climate litigation has broadened, with investors increasingly alert to disingenuous climate commitments and greenwashing. And there are indeed first signs that this is also affecting insurance markets, with some reports of rising costs of directors and officers' liability insurance or some climate exclusion imposed by underwriters. And indeed, the UK's Bank of England warned the industry of a potential wave of claims related to breaches of fiduciary duty or the financing of emission-heavy industries. So, what to make of this and how to prepare, which trends to look out for? These are some of the questions that we want to discuss today in our podcast with our expert panel, who have kindly joined me here today and who I very warmly welcome. So we have Maureen Gorman, Senior Client Advisor at Marsh US FinPro. We have Stephanie Pestridge-Manson from Marsh UK, Head of Management Liability at FinPro, and Nigel Brook, partner at law firm Clyde & Company. Many thanks for joining me. Nigel, let's start with a reflection on recent developments in the climate litigation space. What is your take on what's going on? I mean, working for a law firm, you're very close to these developments. So where do you see sectoral and geographic hotspots?
Yeah, good question. We've been following this now for 5 years, and we're seeing really distinct trends. The targets for litigation, they're still mainly governments, but we're increasingly seeing companies and now sometimes directors being sued as well. The obvious sectors to start with, energy, oil and gas, and now power as well. But also then stretching outside that to other carbon intensive sectors. So we're seeing it in automotive, in cement, airlines and so on. And also in investment and banking, where there's strategic litigation trying to force investment funds and banks down a certain path. In terms of geographies, USA, like it does in just about every other kind of litigation, dominates in terms of case numbers. Still about three quarters of the cases are in the USA. But what we're seeing, where we're seeing big rises and real hot spots, would include Australia. And then in Europe, which again is a hot spot, specifically Netherlands, Germany, and to an extent the UK, where there's been big increase in cases. The Netherlands in particular is punching way above its weight in terms of population.
Yeah, Stephanie, I mean, you work with insurers and with industry on a variety of complex liability challenges. So where do you see climate litigation coming into this? And what are your thoughts, particularly from an insurance broker perspective? Is climate litigation different to other risks? And are risk managers concerned about, you know, these trends that Nigel just described?
Yeah, I think climate is an interesting risk because there are so many different interested stakeholders. So there's capital providers, including banks, shareholders and bondholders, and insurers. regulators, customers, employees, suppliers, and other business partners, not to mention climate activists, all looking at this area. This can be particularly difficult to navigate for multinational companies, which operate in multiple jurisdictions and are subject to different legal frameworks, but also with employee and customer bases that might have differing views on how companies should be managing their climate risks. Specifically with regard to climate litigation risk, it's evolving, as Nigel says, and we're seeing novel approaches. So whether ultimately from a director's and officer's point of view, it will end up being a risk similar to other event-driven style D&O claims, or whether there'll be new theories of liability remains to be seen. Risk managers are having to navigate defining and quantifying this new risk, working with their internal stakeholders about how this risk is communicated to others, and making sure all the required disclosures are made, while at the same time working to understand the best ways to mitigate the risk to try to limit their exposure to this litigation. So it's a really complicated area.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've mentioned directors and officers liability there. And I think, Maureen, particularly from a US perspective, you know, what is Marsh doing to help clients, particularly with a D&O focus, but also wider, you know, to support them in their climate sustainability ambitions here?
Sure. Well, I think, more broadly speaking, Marsh has developed an ESG risk rating tool, which is basically a self-assessment that clients can use. And it's a tool that, you know, just isn't Marsh's view, but it measures against what more than 10 international frameworks view as good ESG. And so from that perspective, that's one thing. D&O specifically, I mean, litigation is a business, and we've developed initiatives. We can talk about it in more detail later, but to help underwriters identify those clients that are really extraordinary when it comes to a focus on ESG. While companies, type of companies vary, and the work that they're doing around ESG may vary by type and by industry, we work really closely with our clients to share with their insurers what risk management initiatives they are undertaking as part of the underwriting process, and basically with an eye toward trying to, you know, negotiate the broadest coverage that they can get for their directors and officers in particular.
So Maureen, can you tell us about the D&O initiative that Marsh has developed to recognize clients that are going above and beyond what's required as it relates to ESG?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. Our initiative was basically developed to help clients who are going above and beyond from an ESG perspective get recognition from underwriters in the way of policy enhancements. And so basically for clients that are engaged with certain law firms and who are working to kind of either evaluate, validate, bolster their ESG frameworks, underwriters will take that into consideration and on a bespoke basis offer coverage enhancements, which could include more favorable policy terms such as increased policy limits, reduced retentions, and specific enhancements around ESG specific related coverages.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned ESG there, and I think it's fair to say, I mean, the environment, social, and governance elements are much broader than climate. I mean, we're talking about climate litigation, but I think it's fair to say that litigation is also relevant beyond climate, you know, in the broader sustainability space in the context of greenwashing, as we've recently seen. So, you know, Nigel, what is your advice to corporates, you know, who are setting themselves challenging climate or ESG targets? You know, what do you tell them how to prepare for litigation or avoid litigation?
Well, two big comments on this. First, And it's something that Maureen's already mentioned, that with climate, you've got now solidifying standards, and it is all converging around the TCFD standard. With the broader ESG, it's not yet converged. I think several years behind the climate metric. It will happen, but it's going to take time. And at the moment, it's a bit of a free-for-all. We're seeing this with ESG funds, for example. What are the criteria you're using here? So that by itself makes it difficult for a company to set ambitious ESG targets, because how do you compare companies against each other when they're looking at different criteria? And I think particular care needed there. Therefore, if you overclaim your credentials in that area, and you can be called out by reference to some standard that perhaps you weren't even thinking about. Greenwashing, I think, is a really acute risk at the moment, because as already been mentioned, Stephanie mentioned those variety of stakeholders, investors, customers, rating agencies, to an extent regulators now, putting pressure on companies to report, but also to declare ambition, net zero and so on. And so companies feel obliged to say something there, but can they actually deliver? So if it's about what they're achieving today, is it accurate about the company as a whole? If it's about a target for 2025, 2030 or whatever, is it actually achievable? Have they actually checked internally with all the various departments and the geographies? Maybe that when you actually get into the fine detail, you can't do it. And also the danger with anything that's put into it, for example, an advertisement, is that an accurate summary? Does that really accurately summarise what you're doing or aiming to do? Words like green and climate neutral and so on, these are potentially slippery terms. So I think I'd suggest this is an all-of-company approach, that you'd want the board to take control of this, and you want to make sure they get all of the relevant departments fully on board with this and really take it serious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's interesting, because initially the focus was mainly on companies who haven't started their ESG or climate journey. Is inaction making them vulnerable to litigation? I mean, we're talking about greenwashing, which is on the other end, but if you haven't done anything and you're really just at the very, very early stages of embracing climate or ESG, what's your advice?
I think there's dangers both ways. If you say nothing at all, obviously there'll be a different kind of pressure, commercial or whatever pressure from stakeholders. But you could be, by omission, misleading. For example, if there were material climate risks or environmental risks that your company faces, potential headwinds, which could impact on its results, are you giving a false impression by omission to, for example, shareholders? Could they complain about this? You didn't tell us, you weren't addressing this particular risk. We're actually seeing a lawsuit like that in the States already against former directors of a corporation. So I think that's a real danger in not declaring ESG-related risks that your corporation faces.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Stephanie, you mentioned that this is a complex area to navigate for corporates, I think also for investors, and clearly also for insurers and brokers. So, well, but at the same time, litigation takes time and plays out differently across jurisdictions. So, you know, that probably makes it even more difficult. So, you know, where do you see actually the role of insurance in supporting companies with those challenging, particularly in the context of net zero transitions? And, you know, are markets ready for this? Or, you know, are there going to be more refusals to underwrite or new policies? What are your thoughts on the market?
Yeah, so to get to net zero, certainly we all have to contribute, and insurers have a large role to play in getting us there, both with their own investment activities and in supporting companies that they insure as those policyholders transition to a net zero future. There are happily quite a number of examples about how the insurance industry is responding, and this is from an industry that may not always be known for innovation. So I think it's quite good to see that the market is responding, although there is still a lot of work to do. I'll just highlight a few activities by way of example. First is, as Maureen mentions, and you know, enhanced coverage or terms for those clients seen as good risks in this area. So where clients can demonstrate that they're doing the right thing. So one thing that we have here in the UK that we've introduced recently to our one of our D&O products is what we're calling Side D, bit of D&O jargon. The main areas of cover we refer to as Side A, B, and C historically. So we've introduced this, what we're calling Side D, which stands for disclosures, to respond to regulatory investigations against a company regarding their climate-related disclosures. So we're identifying an area that where we know there will be activity in the future, and rewarding those companies that can prove that they're doing good things in this area by giving them that additional cover. And we have a number of insurers who have signed up to offer that coverage. So that's a good additional thing that the market is doing for companies doing the right thing. Other things are capital allocated to particular green projects. So Marsh have recently launched first of its kind insurance and reinsurance facility that provides dedicated capacity for new and existing green and blue hydrogen and energy products or projects. So that also is providing new additional capacity specifically for the green economy. Other things that insurers are doing are things like offering additional capacity for good risks. So Beazley has an ESG specific syndicate, where if you meet a certain ESG, their ESG scoring criteria, they will offer you additional capacity than they would otherwise through this particular syndicate. And then on the other side, insurers are looking at reducing their exposure to certain activities. So here in London, Lloyd's of London have asked their managing agents to no longer provide new insurance cover for things like thermal coal, fired power plants, thermal coal mines, oil sands, or new Arctic energy exploration activities, and to have a transition period to move away from those activities for renewals. So on both sides, the insurance market is responding to the challenge. No doubt there will be exclusions for certain activities or companies, and it's really important for insurance buyers to be able to articulate their risk and what they're doing towards their net zero transition to avoid those kinds of exclusions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's an interesting development, and also how the market responds through innovation. Maureen, you mentioned this ESG rating tool, I think, and you know, would you say that broadly speaking, ESG is on the radar of underwriters, and is there now more and more demand for more information? I mean, the tool is designed to help with that. But, you know, is this early days, or do you think this is long overdue and the underwriters are basically, you know, using and waiting for this?
It's a great question. And ESG, including climate, is absolutely on the radar of underwriters. And when you look at it, I mean, any item that becomes important enough on a global basis, just as ESG has, especially if it's going to generate regulatory issues or requirements for disclosures, they're going to prompt D&O underwriters to ask questions. Just think about, you know, for instance, cyber, the Me Too movement, other issues around DE&I. All of these are examples of issues that are now important to D&O underwriters. And as ESG continues to grow in importance with stakeholders and regulatory bodies, it too has gained more focus with insurers. Now, I think, you know, the level of specificity in terms of the type of questions that people or insurers and underwriters are asking, it's going to vary. They're asking about a broad array of exposures, such as climate-related disclosures, diversity and inclusion programs, board engagement around ESG decisions, such as supply chain management and things like that. But it is absolutely on the radar and I think here to stay.
Well, I mean, I guess from what I'm hearing from you and our conversation here shows that climate litigation is not really no longer a far-fetched ambition of some climate activists, but it is a real business risk across sectors and geographies. And I guess given the complexities of the climate challenge and the scale of the issue and the messiness of rules and regulation, it seems obvious that there will be more climate litigation in the future. But, you know, I want to have your take on this. So my final question as we come to the end of the podcast is, you know, how will the climate litigation landscape look like 5 years from now? A quick challenge there. Maybe we'll start with Nigel. What's your perspective?
Yes. So extrapolating from what we're seeing, I think we're going to see a rapid increase in greenwashing cases. One reason for that is that just about every kind of company can be called out for this using existing law. It doesn't need any new radical theories. It just needs a company that's potentially misleading stakeholders. Rights-based cases, we've seen an explosion of these in Europe and a few other jurisdictions. And I think there's a lot more to come. There's a couple of enormously consequential cases making their way through the European Court of Human Rights. And this would be human rights cases and constitutional rights cases, could have major impact. Cases against directors and officers, we've talked about it for a while. There haven't been many so far, but I anticipate, again, because the law is already there, there could be a lot more of those. And then the broader, look at ESG more broadly, more cases about environmental and biodiversity risks, particularly in supply chains. We've got new laws coming in, particularly in Europe, a new directive that's coming into force and will go into national laws within the next couple of years. It's going to put big obligations on companies to go looking in their supply chains, look for environmental and human rights abuses, and then call it out and try to put it right and potentially compensate for it with enormous fines if they don't do that. And we think the NGOs are waiting for that. They're already doing this in France and Germany and a few other cases with the existing national laws. That'll really ramp up.
Well, not a very promising outlook there, but it sounds like you will be busy, I would say. Stephanie, are you going to be busy in 5 years from now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this area of litigation is and will continue to be in 5 years still in its infancy. This is such a complex area, and complex litigation can be very slow moving. So I think we'll have a bit of a better idea of what types of claims might be more successful. But as obligations on companies and directors and climate disclosures become more common, the risk will continue to evolve, and activists and stakeholders and the plaintiffs bar will be there to respond. So as the risk evolves, litigation will no doubt follow. So I'm sure it will still be with us in 5 years.
Okay, well, Maureen, what's your take?
Well, I have to agree with Nigel and Stephanie. I do think that there will continue to be a growing litigation around this area. And I think whenever you see a change in the regulatory environment or regulations, you're going to see additional litigation coming out of that. And so I think this will be an area that will continue to grow from a litigation perspective for sure. And it will keep us busy for many years to come.
Well, let's meet again and reflect on trends and innovation, but I suggest we don't wait 5 years, but I would love to continue that conversation with you. So many thanks for your contribution and sharing your insights on this important topic. Thank you very much.